Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. One of the questions that's frequently asked about Dhamma practice and how to, you know, to guide our efforts is understandably, you know, how do we know what to do? How do we know how to act at any one particular time? Yeah. Just today, a woman came, it was her child's first birthday a few days ago, and she was asking, saying how difficult it is as a mother, to know what's the right thing to do. How should she act towards her child? You know, what's the right way to decide? You know, when to give the child everything that it wants, or just to let it be uncomfortable for a while, not to try and provide for every desire. And how do we know what to do? Well, one of the things that's really crucial to understand and to reflect on is that there's no fixed formula for the right thing to do. Yeah, even though we might feel that there's an instruction manual around here somewhere with our name on that will give us the perfect formula. Yeah. That we just somehow have mislaid it. We put it down, somewhere, and if we just look hard enough, we'll find the little magical book that tells us the right thing for me to do at all times. But even though we might find ourselves hunting for such a thing, there's also the intuition that probably all of us have is that such a book doesn't exist and can't exist. One of the things that that does help us, guides us towards finding what the mysterious right thing is in any one moment, is just to take into account the kind of character that we have, the habitual traits that we experience, the personality traits, traits of habit, just to see what our tendencies are. To get familiar with those, and not to necessarily say that one kind of trait is better than another, but just noticing what kind of way do we handle situations? How do we deal with praise? How do we deal with criticism? How do we deal with success? How do we deal with failure? Do we like to be alone? Do we like to be with people? Yeah. How do we respond to leading? How do we respond to following? Just to study and get to know our own ways, seeing what our strengths are, what our weaknesses are, the things that we like, the things that we dislike. Often, when we start to look, examine our own lives and see how we handle things, then we find that the more that we just follow our preferences and sort of just go to our sort of favored modes, that drifts very easily into being drawn in by aversions, by desires, and compounding a sense of self-view, identification and alienation. And so much of the training, and certainly within the monastic life and in meditation training generally, it's that there's a lot of going against the grain. That what if there are things that we see that we prefer, it's not just deliberately trying to be perverse or make life difficult for ourselves, but we know that if we really like to be around people and we don't handle solitude very well, just take the opportunity to be alone, to work with that, to test that. Or similarly, if we really shy away from people, don't want to have to be around others and always want to kind of hive ourselves off and be alone, then it can be helpful to put ourselves in a situation where we have to be with people, where we have to rise up to that. So that going against the grain, going against the bhava sota, a stream of becoming, is in a way it's the gesture of the intention to practice Dhamma, to embody Dhamma, to be Dhamma, to see that it's by continually and semi-consciously or unconsciously following habit patterns, that's how rebirth keeps continuing, that's how the wheel of samsara keeps being kind of strengthened and empowered. That's the engine of samsara, is blind habit. That's the thing that keeps it spinning, keeps us going from one hope to one disappointment, one birth to one death, over and over and over again. Again, one needs to find a balance. You're not trying to just make life just difficult for ourselves and deliberately looking for obstructions. But if this kind of process is picked up in a wise way, then we really learn. We are able to witness those habit patterns, and through wisely turning to face them and go against them, then we find we have to cut through the self-view, cut through habit patterns, and open the heart to be that much broader. So if you tend to be if the mind goes towards passivity or laziness, why bother? I can't be bothered. Then just seeing the mind moving in that way, as listening to how the mind directs itself in that way, and so then setting the intention to rouse the heart to say, yes, I can do it. Why not? And to rise up and engage, to volunteer, to move towards things. If you have a habit pattern of the other extreme of, I can do that. Yes, I'll do it. I can fix that. That can be changed. Jumping in to do and to act and to fix. Always ready to change the world, to make things more more comfortable, more convenient, more efficient, more interesting. The way we need to lean, the direction we need to set for ourselves is leave it alone. Why bother? What's the problem? Can you just leave it be? Can you just let it be inefficient? Can we just let it be broken? So that just raising those kind of suggestions for ourselves, just seeing what, just even raising the thought, of not fixing something, just that reflects back to us how, broken is bad, mended is good. It becomes a fixed view in our minds that we make that an intrinsic good. And it's by seeing that, by witnessing those habits, then we are noticing, oh, look at that. I call this broken, then I say that's bad. And then when it's fixed, then I call it good. And then and that's only coming from my own judgments, my habitual ways of seeing things. Who says that what I call broken really is broken? Maybe it's a work of art that I'm just not recognizing, that this, what I'm thinking of as a broken bicycle, is actually a masterpiece by Picasso. Picasso's sculptures was the handlebars from a bicycle and the saddle, and he put them together and made them into a cow's head. So that the handlebars made the horns and the seat made the face of the cow. It was a perfect cow's head. The casual observer would have said, well, that's just bits of a broken bicycle. Who's to say? Yeah. One person calls it a broken machine, another person calls it a work of art. Who's to say? A couple of years ago in Britain, a famous sculptor, artist, Damien Hirst, was preparing an exhibition, and apparently this genuinely did happen. And one of the pieces of, in this exhibition was supposed to look like an artist's, the sort of corner of an artist's studio. And so they had like piles of old newspapers over the floor and pots of paint and brushes and that was the piece. That was the sculpture. Was this untidy corner of an artist's studio with old coffee mugs with cigarette butts in them, and lo and behold, one of the curators at the art gallery thought, oh dear, they haven't tidied up this corner of the gallery. They've left this awful mess, and we've got an exhibition opening tomorrow. I better clean this up. So the piece was apparently, if I remember correctly, priced at £360,000. And the curator diligently cleared it all up, put the newspapers in the bin, emptied the dregs out of the coffee cups, threw away the cigarette butts, cleaned the ashtrays, put it all neatly away. And lo and behold, exhibit 35B was missing. So the papers made a meal out of that one. But who says, to the janitor, the curator, a pile of rubbish in the corner of the exhibition, oh dear, better tidy it up. To Damien Hirst, it was a creative piece that he was going to get a six-figure sum for. So, a lot of progress and development in training the heart is in just seeing and getting familiar with how we judge things. What's our personality type? Are we always ready to jump forward to the next thing? Are we always eager to shy away and say, whoa, not me, whoa, no. Not me. I'm not going to speak up. I'm not going to volunteer. I'm not going to go first. I'm not going to have my name on that. What's our type? Something in between, something off to the side. Just get familiar. Are we one that always sits near the door? I mean, I remember one Anagarika in our community who was a very sweet guy, but he was very, very tentative about religious institutions, and he was a sort of anarchist at heart. And it was with great caution that he went forth into white robes and took the eight precepts, and he really wanted to commit himself to spiritual practice, but this whole kind of uniform thing and belonging to a group thing, and I don't know about this. And even though he was very, very sincere in his practice, he literally always would sit near the door. It's like, if I don't like it, I'm out of here. And he would physically, whenever there was any kind of, in the Dhamma hall and in different people, in different sort of situations, in retreats, in people's houses, he would always find a way of physically being near the door. Just, as soon as things are not, as I like them, I'm out of here. Nothing's going to stop me. I'm staying close to the exit. I'm keeping my options open. Others are always front center, I don't want to miss a moment of this. I'm going to be right, front center, full face reception. I'm not going to miss a fraction of this. So I mean, I could sit here reciting personality types for a whole night, but we all, we can all get to know our own particular flavor. And once we get to see that or recognize what the habits are, then mindfully attending to that, then using situations, and often you don't have to create things especially, but yes, within our lives, to wisely turn to face those and to challenge those habits, and to be able to get to see, not just out of a sense of perversity or just trying to make life difficult for ourselves, but just so that we can illuminate those and see deeply and truly the habits of following fear, following desire, following aversion, that we've never recognized in a lifetime. And it's through seeing those habits and knowing them clearly, challenging them, and seeing how much we build a sense of I and me and mine out of them, then they can be let go of. If we don't see them, we can't let go of them. You know, if you don't know, even know it's a habit, if we think it's reality, if you think this is true, that, you know, it is good. It's good to sit near the door. It's good to be at the front. Or it's good to always volunteer. Or it's good to tidy up. That is an intrinsic good. Then the trouble starts. So it's that recognizing that it's a habit, it's a point of view, it's an identification, it's a thing that the mind creates and gives value to, then there's a possibility of letting go of it. And one of the really powerfully influential factors in our life and the society in the West, the Western culture heavily promotes this, and along with recognizing our own personality traits, there's also that we're an immensely individualistic culture in the West. And even if you weren't born in the West, but you live here now, the influence is very, very strong. So we can easily feel that we are the generator of all of the good and bad qualities that appear in our minds. What I mean by that is that when we do something good, or we are successful in our job or in our studies or in some kind of activity, we take that achievement really personally. I have succeeded. I am good. I am clever. I am a success. I am creative. Look what I drew. Look what I wrote. How wonderful I sound. Or the opposite extreme. How useless I am. I'm a failure. Yeah. I'm such an angry person. I'm so jealous. I'm so, you know, crushingly shy. I have a social phobia. I'm completely inept with other people. I'm useless. And then we relate to these things as personal achievements or, you know, personal obstructions, as if we invented them, you know, as if we had ever invented the ability to be kind or to be to be. We invented music, and so that we our ability to sing beautifully or to chant or to draw pictures or to write. Well, just like as if we were the one who introduced that into the universe. We invented creativity, or we invented artistic expression, or we invented kindness, or different structures that bring forth wholesome qualities. And similarly, we can feel like that we can get so obsessed with being a jealous person or an angry person or a lustful person or a fearful person and make it such a big issue as if we invented anger ourselves. It didn't exist in the universe till we came up with it. I mean, when you say it out loud, it sounds ridiculous, right? It's totally absurd. But yet we can relate to that feeling as if we have sort of produced it out of nothing. That it's our own personal creation, our own personal problem. And rather than thinking, this is actually just a quality that I'm an experiencing. I've got I'm born as a human being, therefore there are capacities for for kindness, for love, for wisdom, for creativity, for generosity, for unselfishness. You know, we didn't invent unselfishness. We didn't invent generosity. It's part of the human system. Similarly, we didn't invent anger or jealousy or fear or craving. These come with a package. You know, having a body, having a mind, having an ancestry. We inherit the capacity to fear, to be jealous, to be angry, to be fretful, to be anxious, to be obsessed. This is part of the deal. So when we recognize our ancestry, we recognize that we're part of a vast organic system, and we are the inheritors of these different qualities. It changes the perspective on it, right? It makes it all a bit different. Rather than I am this separate individual who is the creator of these good and bad and neutral qualities. And again, it's really important to recognize that when we spell it out, or you just, you know, you hear me saying these things, the mind can go, yeah, right, that, well, do I really think like that? But if we don't spell it out, then we get carried along in that way of relating to ourselves, as if we invented anxiety, as if we invented fear or generosity, that the good and bad and neutral qualities somehow are unique to us, or that we are uniquely bad or uniquely gifted or special. Now, one of the very beautiful qualities that you have in Buddhist practice is the ways that we acknowledge our connection with the larger whole. We just don't fixate upon our own individual life. I mean, obviously we work directly on our own body and speech and mind, and that's the main locus of training. But also there's a constant reminders of our connection with others. So, you know, the third refuge is refuge in Sangha. It's not refuge in me. The refuge in Sangha. Yeah, Sangha meaning the unified assembly, the community of those who have awakened to the Dhamma, the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, those who have awakened to the different stages of path and fruition. So that what we find when we broaden the view and look upon our own ancestry, our own bigger life, as it were, our life as a part of a Sangha, part of the fourfold assembly, not just of those who have awakened, but also you can think of another way of regarding the Sangha is that of the fourfold assembly of the monastic community, monks, nuns, and then lay women, lay men, the fourfold assembly of the Buddha's disciples, the Buddha Parisa, as it's called. Now, when we think of ourselves not just as this isolated individual, but we see that ourselves as part of a human family and part of the family of those committed to the Buddhist path, then the view changes a bit. We don't take the achievements personally, or the disasters and crises and defilements personally either. So we see whatever achievements or noble qualities that we experience, it's like, well, we didn't generate those. We're not sort of solely responsible. You know, there's a biological ancestry of a billion years of, you know, from the blue-green algae, yeah, a billion or so years ago up to the present, you know, we still have, like, within our bodies, our ancestry as little bacteria, sort of blue-green algae type ancestors a billion years ago, is still right here in our body, the mitochondria of our cells, that in our cells which converts, just a little biology lesson, that in our cells which converts the oxygen into energy through adenosine triphosphate, if I remember correctly, that is, those are little mitochondria, those little subcellular entities within each cell of our, pretty much every cell of our body, which are converting the oxygen into energy that the body can use. They are very, very close in resemblance to our ancestors of, you know, of a billion years ago, of a little blue-green algae, the microscopic entities of the first emerging life forms. That's, they're still kind of incorporated within our own bodies and all the different stages of evolution down to the present human form that we call me and think of as an individual. But, you know, we carry our own ancestry in our bodies. That's how our bodies stay alive, through the inheritance of those who have gone before. So it's recollecting the connection that we have with a larger form and seeing how the wholesome qualities, noble qualities that we experience, are things that we have inherited, the possibility, the potential for those through our own minds, our own physical forms, but also through those who have brought us into being in the Sangha life, that not our physical parents, but also our companions, so those who we join together with. Like here we are Saturday night at Abhayagiri, there's a monastic community resident here, those who are living here as lay residents, those who come as regular visitors to support the monastery and be part of our life, those who are just coming in for here for a week or so, or just here for a visit for this evening, or maybe for the first time ever, that our practice supports each other. For all of us, after the evening chanting, sitting here for three quarters of an hour, how many of us, if we're just alone in our own home, sit down and cross our legs, close our eyes, how many of us don't move for 45 minutes, don't even open our eyes? I would suspect not everyone. They're sort of watching the clock and wondering what you're going to have for dinner, maybe, got to let the cat in, got to let the cat out. Well, that right knee's feeling a bit sore, maybe I should stretch my leg out. Or there's much less resolution, much less capacity to stay still, to be patient, to remain focused. When we have a group support, when there's like we're a single body of people gathered together, then the knee feels a bit wonky, but I can stay here till the bell goes. I wonder what the time is. Don't need to know. Just stay here. Just let the eyes remain closed. Kind of like to go to the bathroom. Okay, well, wait till the bell goes. Wait till the evening's finished. I can manage. We find resources of patience, resolution, focus, because of the presence of others. We are supported by others, and our own commitment, our own presence supports others. So that just the simple connection with like-minded people present here at this time it has an effect on our life. We exist as part of a larger body. So there's a quality of gratitude for the support we receive to others, and the support that we receive from others, and then also a recognition of the support that we give to others. So just by our capacity to be quiet, to be still, to be focused, we are lending support to others, even if we're not intending that. I mean, how many people come and think, I think I'll go to Abhayagiri Saturday night so I can help others to sit quietly? Doesn't work that way, does it? Because our intention is more what we as an individual will derive from it, but circumstantially, we also provide support and a helpful presence to other people. Similarly, we have customs within the Buddhist world of paying respects to our elders. You know, we're quite a formal outfit here at Abhayagiri. Yeah, we're a conservative bunch in some ways. And so we follow these traditional practices. So tomorrow, many of us will be going down to visit Ajahn Mahaprasad at his monastery in Fremont, Wat Bhutanasorn. And this being the rains retreat time, the Vasa, from the full moon of July to the full moon of October, it's customary, and this is a practice, a tradition that our teacher, Ajahn Chah, used to follow and would recommend, of going to pay respects himself and taking other members of the community along to visit and pay respects to other senior kind of elders in the local area. And so we still carry out this tradition of taking the opportunity to go and visit, and to just basically to travel all the way down to Fremont, you know, which is maybe 150 miles away, driving 300 miles in a day just to go and bow to another monk, and then come home again. You think, well, that's a waste of gasoline. Why bother? You drive 150 miles to go and bow to somebody and then come back again. Why not save the gasoline and stay in your hut and meditate? That'd be far more productive. But this kind of gesture is important insofar as it helps us to acknowledge and to recognize our connection with the greater whole, connection with the members of the monastic community, the Buddha's disciples, who have practiced with great commitment for a long time. Ajahn Mahaprasad's been a monk, a novice, for 50 some odd years. Vast majority of his life he's been in robes and committed to the Buddhist path, and he's a noble and fine example, and has helped us very directly and personally over the years. And has been a great support for this community. So, out of respect and honoring that connection, that kindness, then we make the effort to go down and visit. And the Buddha talked about the seven causes of welfare of the community. The first on that list was, as long as the members of the Sangha meet together often and in large numbers, so too the community may be expected to prosper and not to decline. And another on the list was, as long as the members of the Sangha pay respects to their elders, the parents and leaders of the community, then so too may the Sangha expect to prosper and not to decline. So it might seem like it's nothing very much, or what a lot of bother for no great purpose, but it's really just like the looking after our own body. Just as we, if it's cold, we wrap up. If it's hot, then we find a shady place. If we're hungry, then we take food. If we're thirsty, we take drink to look after the body, to take care of it. If it's injured, we patch it up. If it's tired, we rest it. We care for the body out of a natural, innate common sense and motivation to preserve and sustain the integrity of the body. So the making the gestures of paying respects and looking to the elders of our community, that those who are the parents and guides and mentors, is recognizing that we don't just exist here alone. It's not just kind of me and my mind and my cabin that matter, but I'm connected to others, connected to the other people that I live with, connected to the people who offer the food that nourishes the body, connected to the people who provided my support and guidance in the monastic life. So that in a similar way, Ajahn Chah would make a point of, along with the other elders of his community in the area around Ubon Rachitani, he would make a definite point of going to visit his preceptor, who happened to be the abbot of the village monastery very close to Wat Parnanachat, where the Western monks all lived. And not to put too fine a point on it, that monk did not have a great reputation. Ajahn Chah's preceptor had had lived in this little monastery in Bung Wai for quite some time, for many, many years, and he was the one that Ajahn Chah became a monk under. But he was known as as being selfish and greedy and unkind and a kind of difficult person, and to the point where people would come and offer food to the monastic community, and he would keep all the best stuff around his seat and he wouldn't pass it on, even like way more than he could eat himself. He would just keep all the good stuff nearby just in case he might like some, and he wouldn't pass it down to any of the other monks or novices. So they'd be sitting there knowing that all the good stuff, quote unquote, sort of gathered around the Ajahn's seat, and they're not going to get me. So to carry out that as a practice for many years takes some pretty pretty ardent self-centeredness. So even though he was had a pretty awful reputation and was criticized and not very much loved, and Ajahn Chah had the reputation for being a very wise, noble, and incredibly kind and generous and a great sort of ascetic and enlightened being. So on a sort of spiritual level, kind of way superior to his own preceptor, he every year he would make a point of taking a group of monks and novices going to see his preceptor and paying his respects and acknowledging that sense of connection, and not just out of a sort of grudging duty with his teeth gritted and, oh well, I suppose I have to, but out of a genuine, well, right or wrong, good or bad, this is my dad, this is the father of in the holy life, this is how I came in, he was the one who opened the door, this is how I came into the Sangha, so good or bad, that's my dad, that's how I came in, so this is worthy of respect and worthy of gratitude. And that quality of not harboring criticism or resentment, but being ready to do the right thing and to express gratitude and humility, that's drawing upon wonderful resources that we have as a human being. And and also he could see that it feeds back in the other way, that it would be one thing that even if that elder monk might have brushed off the fact that he had a terrible reputation, Ajahn Chah was sort of famous and much loved. Deep down in his heart, he would feel inspired and glad that at least he did one really good thing in his life. Was he gave the Upasampada, the ordination to Ajahn Chah, that he was the one who helped bring this great being into the world. So that's to his benefit and good karma, regardless of any other kind of shortcomings that he might have experienced. And that would be for his support and uplift and to help him onwards in the path. So even if we feel that we might have done all the work ourselves, we don't owe anything to anybody, we are kind of the mind inclines towards sort of individualistic tendencies, and we just that the these traditions and customs of paying our respects, of honoring our elders, our physical parents, or our parents in the spiritual life, our forebears, all those who have gone before us. And in the northern Buddhist traditions, they have a much more of a historical sense. And they, in many of the monasteries and temples, like in the Tibetan tradition, or Chinese, Japanese, Korean tradition, they recite the whole lineage of patriarchs and matriarchs right from the time of the Buddha, those who have led the Sangha over the centuries. Actually, from even before Gautama Buddha, from from seven Buddhas previously: Sikhi, Vaisabhu, Vipassi, Konagamana, Kakusanda, Kassapa, then the Buddha Gautama, and then Mahakassapa, then Ananda, and then one after another after another, reciting the names of all the elders of the Sangha, right up to the present day. So remembering the ancestry, that where we come from, this is our body, and this is it's not just me who's as an individual who is the producer or the who's embodying or experiencing these qualities of good or bad, but they're coming from a source. So it's like it's so helpful to remember and to recollect and to open up to where what our source is, to where we come from, and that quality of humility. You know, particularly if we feel that we're really getting somewhere in our practice, or we are accomplishing, we're accomplished at concentration, or we've developed a lot of insight or wisdom, or any kind of feelings of superiority, a sense of well, where did you get your riches from? You know, did you generate this for yourself? Or are you the inheritor of wisdom and kindness and good qualities from others? You know, where did it come from? Who's responsible? And just that, recollecting that, turning towards that, then the heart is humbled. And that also conduces to even more profound furtherance in the Sangha. So these kind of reflections and recollections help us to see that when we are ready to just not get caught in the self-obsession, self-centered habits of the culture, that always thinking about me, and generally we tend to think of ourselves more in a negative, critical, self-critical sense than an inflated one, but you know, whichever direction it goes in, just to notice and to contemplate our existence as part of a community, of a body, a single body of a Sangha. And not just what we receive from that, but also what we offer to others. Just notice what an effect that has. Why the Buddha encouraged this so much. Why such an emphasis on Sangha as being a spiritual tool. And also this is something that Ajahn Chah made a great deal of. He made it like a whole spiritual training method, was living as part of a community, even to the point of being criticized by other forest ajahns that if you live at Wat Bapong, Ajahn Chah's monasteries, you have to chant together and sit together and all this, and even work projects, everyone's all working together, the nuns are all doing their work projects together, and the monks all doing their work projects, and it's all this time kind of rubbing shoulders with this whole gang of other people. And many other places, the ethic is be alone, go to your heart, meditate. And that has its own power and strength. But Ajahn Chah saw that learning to work communally and function as a communal body has a tremendous strength and supportive power. And that if you look at the Buddha's teachings about Sangha, about communal harmony, you see he really placed enormous emphasis on that. And that, so this is how the teaching and the practice gets sustained through time. It's because the communal support that we can lend to each other. When it's just sort of me on my own, you on your own, when we're just trying to sustain our efforts as an individual, it's just naturally that much harder to keep it going, to keep the system buoyed up and functioning. And that when it's when we receive that group support, when we acknowledge that and allow ourselves to be supported by others, and also take the trouble to support others ourselves, then our spiritual efforts are so much more powerfully maintained. I was reflecting on Sangha and the power of Sangha and sort of communal support came to mind the other day, where I saw this small film clip that probably a number of you have seen, that was called, it's called The Battle at Kruger, is the title of it. And it was an incident that took place in, I believe, Kruger National Park in South Africa. And there's some people out on a kind of animal watching safari, and there's this, I guess, by a riverbank or at a big waterhole. And it starts off with a film of some buffalo. The camera watches a group of buffaloes coming along the bank. And then the camera pans over to the right, and there's this pride of lions snoozing in the sun. And then the lions look up and see the buffaloes coming, and buffaloes are sort of plodding along by the water. And then the lions start to look perky, and they get up and they start to head towards this family of buffaloes. And then after a few moments, then the lions attack, and there's this one little buffalo calf, and a couple of lions kind of jump onto it, and the rest of the buffaloes run away. So it looks like the adult buffaloes have abandoned the kid. And then the little calf runs down into the water. And so these lions are wrestling with this little buffalo calf at the edges of the water. And if it wasn't bad enough having two or three lions on you, then a crocodile comes out of the water and grabs one of the back legs of this calf. So this literally being tugged. This thing is a tug of war between these couple of crocodiles in the water and then the two or three lions on the bank. And they're pulling at this poor little calf. And you think, oh dear, this is terrible. Why did they make a film of this? This is awful. And so then the lions manage to drag the buffalo calf away from the water, and the crocodiles give up. And so then you think, oh dear, poor little thing. And then the cavalry arrives. So the buffaloes that had run off hadn't just run away to escape from the attack by the lions. They'd gone to get reinforcements, and you see this whole huge phalanx of buffaloes, and they have these great broad horns, and they're sort of shoulder to shoulder. The whole lot, the whole sort of clan shows up, and they start to close in around the lions that are attacking the calf. And so slowly they edge closer and closer, and then the some of the larger buffaloes up at the front start to come forward and start butting the lions, and then slowly trying to dissuade them from attacking the calf. And then one of the buffaloes sort of tosses up one of the lions up into the air. You can see the lion kind of flying up into the air. And then another lion kind of lands and then runs off, and then they butt another one, and then that one runs off. After edging forward and attacking again and again, the buffaloes manage to drive off all of the lions. And then they get the calf back into their midst, and then some of the buffaloes then go after the lions and chase them off altogether. And meanwhile, as this is all going on, there's the people who are doing the filming saying, "Geez, I've never seen anything like this. This is incredible. I've been here for years. I've never seen anything like this. This is amazing. Oh, no, it's the crocodile." So you have a little bit of a vocal commentary going on in the background. But it's an amazing thing that these buffalo, you know, an individual buffalo with face to face with a lion probably would get pretty badly chewed up and scratched and clawed. But when the buffaloes sort of come in together, shoulder to shoulder, and they form that body of protection, and they're able to rescue the calf, and then the calf kind of seemingly is pretty okay and rejoins them, and is able to be protected by the herd. So you know, it's an amazing example of the power of Sangha. You know, that you know, when your kid is being tugged between a couple of crocodiles and three or four lions, you think game over, right? But with the strength of the whole herd of buffalo coming along, they rescue the little one. They their courage through their support of each other, because you know, they are obviously frightened of what the lions can do to them, but with their grouping together and their urge to protect their young, then they find the resources and the strength and the success at saving their little one and depriving the lions of that particular lunch. So that's this is a wonderful thing. So when we feel our own minds, our own hearts being tugged between a couple of crocodiles and a few lions, you know, we're just struggling, thinking, oh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? And you've got kind of fear pulling one way and desire pulling another way, and and you know, anxiety tugging on us as well. And you think, oh, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? Then you realize that you're not alone. And that sometimes if we just open our eyes and we look around, I'm not the only one in this room who's experiencing knee pain and restlessness and chattering mind and you know, desperate need to go to the bathroom. I'm not alone. Everyone else is here. It's like you know, recognizing the remainder of the herd are still around. That we're not just, it's not just me being tugged at by these individual forces, but there are other powers, other strengths that are available, and they and then that kind of presence, the strength of our companions in the spiritual life, our friends and our Dhamma family, really, are here, are present, and can provide that same kind of protective support and encouragement, and sometimes life-saving, that the rest of the buffalo herd was able to provide for that little one. And you know, if buffaloes tell stories, that was certainly one that the little buffalo calf is going to dine out on for a few years to come. So, you won't believe it. There was these crocodiles pulling my back leg, and there was this a lion on, you know, one lion on my neck and another on my shoulder. And so, oh yeah, sure. But there's film to prove it. So, if you want to see this for yourself, you know, don't take my word for it. The Battle at Kruger is the Kruger is the name of the story. You can Google it and see it for yourselves. It's quite an extraordinary encounter. But this is not just sort of a strange event off in a wildlife park in Africa, but this is happening here, isn't it? This, our, in a way, our life, our own heart is the battle at Kruger, happens right here. And that when we take refuge in Sangha, when we are ready to look outside ourselves, to honor our elders, to recognize our origins, and to acknowledge the connection that we have with others, then we can receive that kind of support and also offer that, and just to see what that real refuge is, and the protection, the security, and independence, you know, the strength that comes from that, because you know we sometimes kind of get stuck in individualism because we feel like we need to be kind of strong and true, but by acknowledging our connectedness on the external level, not being afraid to acknowledge that and to be open to that, then internally we find independence, we find security, we find a tremendous stability. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening. Namayam Dhammakathaya Sarukaram Naramase Sarukaram.